This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
All right, welcome back. Dr. Lyle, how you been doing?
Good. How about yourself? All good here?
Doing great. You know, the winter is coming and dating life starts to quell a little bit. And I always wondered if humans have a mating season. So I figured we'd start the show with that today. And we're going to go over some listener questions, some listener emails, and just kind of see where that takes us topic-wise. If there's any callers that want to call in, we'll be welcome to take their calls.
All right.
So,
you want to know if there's a mating season?
Yeah, is there a mating season
actually,
for humans?
Not that I'm aware of. The truth is that humans spent their entire evolutionary development all the way to the modern human in sub-Saharan Africa. So there wasn't any winter to speak of there. So now what did happen is that as our ancestors moved north, our ancestors migrated north out of Africa. They migrated east. To the east, they became Asians, and to the west, they became Caucasians. And they faced harsh winters. And obviously, that's why you've got darker skin near the equator and lighter skin further away from the equator. Those situations, they might have evolved some mating patterns related to that, but nothing that I'm aware of. And if somebody's out there that's really up on details of evolutionary psychology, they might phone in and inform us, but I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the word spring fever is just for other animals.
Well, yeah, I mean, that is very true. So spring fever is a very legitimate thing in the animal kingdom. Yeah, for humans, not so much, and certainly if there is anything, I mean, there's no doubt that humans living in cold climates where you have to be covered up all the time and shivering and worried about your survival are now massively more focused on survival problems than they are on reproduction problems. And obviously when spring comes and clothing is reduced and as our anxiety is reduced for survival, then undoubtedly that in those northern or in the reaching latitudes, both northern and southern, there very well may be some patterns there, or there were. There's unlikely to be true today just because people have constant sources of calories at all latitudes. So anyway, good interesting thing. But yeah, spring fever I think is more a function of the fact that we can see the girls because they're wearing less clothes, and that is enticing. However, if we were in a warm cave and they were in less clothes and it was December, we'd be interested as well.
Yeah, I had a friend that I was discussing this with a few months ago, actually a year or two ago, and he was postulating that the reason he thinks that cheating, he believes that there's more cheating in the hotter climates for exactly that reason, is that for 6 months out of the year in New York type of area, you've just got to be with your spouse or your long-term girlfriend or boyfriend indoors, whereas out here you can go to the beach, you know, 9 months out of the year, and even the other 3 months you can still go to the beach, just not during the nighttime. So,
well, that interesting
Correlation
discussion.
does not equal causation, right?
Right, who knows? We'll circle around that another day.
Yeah. All right. Well, so today's program, we are going to be talking over some listener emails and also any callers that decide to call in. But we've had a couple of emails from different listeners. This is all in the topic of sex, dating, relationships. And the listeners have called in are male, and they're asking questions with regards to casual mating strategy and dating strategy in general. Before we go into those, I know that we've talked before about what we're doing here, and what we're doing here is trying to find a way to be happy in the modern world. Now, happiness could come in a lot of different forms, but your view is that the male will be most happy if he's pursuing a long-term pair bond versus a casual mating strategy. Did I understand that correctly?
Well, I actually believe so. Now, there would be people, I would say in general that's going to be true, but this could depend upon several factors. So, for example, it could depend upon the personality of the male that's involved. So the male's personalities are going to differ. So males that are going to be, for example, more disagreeable and less conscientious, are going to have reduced empathy mechanisms, and it's going to make them less generally conducive to pair bond strategy. And so a big part of the pair bond, the value of the pair bond strategy is essentially the hormone oxytocin, which causes a, you know, loving bonds between people and between people and animals, etc. And so there are people that are essentially just tough enough and nasty enough and disagreeable enough that they really don't have it in them very well to be playing pair bond strategy. I mean, they might have a best girl or whatever, but the bottom line is that they're pretty ruthless customers. Now, it can also, in other words, there's another factor that's involved here, and that is just how much mating choice a male has over his how much control he has over his sexual empire. So extremely attractive males, Justin Bieber and, you know, people like this that have extraordinary choices, those individuals can essentially be so tempted by such tremendous novelty in their Stone Age brain, essentially thinking that they can be impregnating numerous very attractive females annually, that they could be designed to take advantage of that situation and not settle down with one. Now, what's interesting is that usually very successful males with tremendous mating choices usually do settle down in serial monogamous kinds of situations. So we've seen this with Brad Pitt. We've seen this with Tom Cruise. We've seen this with who was the guy?
Magic Johnson.
Cary Grant. Yeah.
Yeah, not Magic Johnson.
Yeah, I mean, Magic Johnson actually has a long-term pair bond, but we don't know the ins and outs of this. But we certainly know a Clark Gable, who had obviously the world at his feet, was married 5 times or so. And so they still seek and revel in this pair bond process. And their relationships undoubtedly are strained by the fact that the males have such phenomenal choice that as soon as there's some conflicts of interest in the relationship, they can basically tell the female it's my way or the highway. And if the female, who is also a very high status female, or she wouldn't be in that relationship with the Clark Gable, can basically not be willing to put up with that negotiation. And so those relationships are very strained. Tom Cruise has had just as troubled a mating history as any guy in many ways, in terms of trying to find a long-term stable relationship that where he remains happy. And however, so what I would say is this, that I would not say that pursuing a pair bond strategy is the exclusive only way to achieve optimal life satisfaction. That depends upon who you are, what your circumstances are. And both those things are independent. So who you are is independent of what your circumstances are. You could be a low conscientious, disagreeable human, difficulty in terms of establishing pair bonds, but not have a lot of mating choice. And so even then, your strategy, pair bond strategy, may be out of your reach psychologically, and the only strategy you may have on the table that makes any sense is casual mating strategy. So, I just want to be clear that I'm not singing the tune of the broad culture here in saying that pair bond strategy is the only legitimate path towards human happiness. I would say that it is a beacon that draws virtually all people to it, and that's why it is that we're so interested in it, and that's why we consider it to be probably close to the optimal strategy that a person could have. I would have to say that an awful lot of males, when I tell them the following, their eyes light up, and I call it wife chippy. And when males are struggling with pair bond strategy and the magnitude of the commitment that's involved, I explain to them that in our natural history, the male might have been largely committed to one female, but he would very likely, and wouldn't even be surprising to his main female, if every now and then he had sex with a chippy, somebody on the side that was not serious and was not going to be the main claim on his resources, i.e. that this was just playing around. And that when we look at the size of males' testicles relative to their body weight, and we plot that on a graph relative to the other primates, we can essentially tell how many females the average male across the natural history of our species was having sexual relations with during any given point in time. And I believe the answer is something on the order of 1.3. So in other words, the males that walk the earth today come from a long line of males that were more successful than the average male, obviously. That's why you're here. And as a result, the greater than average success of the average male looked like they weren't sleeping with two women at once. They were sleeping with one woman, and then every now and then they nailed another one on the side. And when I explain this to the average married guy, his eyes light up, and they will often say, well, gee, if I could just do that once in a while, I wouldn't have any problem being with my main partner. Okay? No problem. In other words, that is the margin by which the male dissonance over pair bond strategy seems to go away. Now, so this is now a little more in-depth, expansive view of of why I put pair bond at the center of importance, because very few males actually seem to seek or want or strive for nothing other than a casual mating strategy life. This species has enough oxytocin pair bonding love psychology in it that they seem to want one, and then after they get an outstanding one, they would just like another little piece on the side every now and then, and they'd be perfectly happy.
So I'm curious, what does the wife say when she hears you say this?
Well, I don't quite say this to the wives, but okay. I actually have explained this to the wives that whose husbands have cheated, and essentially trying to frame this so that it is understood. Sometimes people get all bent out of shape and upset and think that we are talking about what is right because it was natural. That is not what I'm ever interested in talking about. I'm interested in talking about what is. I'm interested in talking about the actual characteristics of the species that we are examining, which is us. And so this appears to be the midway psychology of the typical male. Now, some males are not that way. So if you get a more conscientious male who is more agreeable and naturally not as open to experience, you can wind up with a male that could be very happily pair bonded indefinitely. But that is not typical of our species. I'd say the most typical male is wife, 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 chippy. That seems to be the circuits that are in there.
Okay, so what you're saying is this doesn't justify any particular behavior. We're just trying to understand how people are instead of trying to paint a fantasy and then going from there. Just for
right.
listeners listening.
We're not. I'm trying to certainly make it clear to people that the neural circuits that you have are the neural circuits that you have. The way you play the game of life within the circuits that you have, those are all cost benefit decisions that have to be weighed in. And one of the things that is frustrating in life is that we have conflicts of interest with other people. And that is the nature of reality, is that we have conflicts of interest with other people. And so you can legislate those conflicts as best you can. You can eventually invent the Magna Carta and the Constitution of the United States. You can do what you can, but the bottom line is that there's still very great conflicts between people. So five guys in the room all want to nail the one really good-looking chick and couldn't care less about the other four. And you know what? The good-looking chick isn't interested in any of those five guys. So there's a lot of frustrated people in that room. There's four frustrated women. Let's suppose we got four women in there that are fives. We've got five guys in there that are eights, and we've got 110 female. Okay? We've got five guys that are frustrated, four women that are frustrated. The hot chick is a little bit frustrated, but believe me, she's got options. And nobody in that room is happy. Okay? So this is the conflicts are everywhere, and they are deep, and they're nobody's fault. And so I think that's the most important thing to understand, is that these conflicts of interest are not the result of males being bad. I mean, there was some show men behaving badly. You know, I don't know what they're – of course, we could never have a show women behaving badly, okay? But it's okay. The more morality, the explicit morality of the culture is very, very down on the male casual mating strategy, and yet it is what it is. And and there's nothing to me immoral about it. It is if the females were not conducive to playing casual mating strategy on the other side of that fence from time to time when it was strategically appropriate for them to be doing so, then the casual mating strategy would not exist. It does not exist because of male psychology. It exists because both males and females have adaptations that have sculpted the casual mating strategy as a obvious corner of a conflict of interest between people.
Yeah, and I was actually going to ask you, next question is, do females have a casual mating strategy?
Yes, they do. They have a casual mating strategy. They have more than one, but the basic casual mating strategy is, if the guy is sufficiently superior to you, sleep with him with little evidence of commitment. That is the female casual mating strategy. If I'm weak, you know, if you're a female and you're weak in the knees, you know, that's, you're weak in the knees because your adaptations are telling you that the male is your massive genetic superior and it's worth being a single mom to get his DNA. And so that is the mirror image. It's the image of exactly the opposite direction of the male. The male is absolutely willing to sleep down for casual mating. He would love to sleep up, but of course that's not going to happen. So the male is absolutely willing to sleep down. The female is never willing to sleep down for casual mating, essentially. She's not designed that way anyway. And and so the female's willingness, it wouldn't do us any good at all to have an adaptation for males to sleep down behind casual mating strategy if there were not women on the other side willing to play that hand. There are.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that is what is on the other side. And, of course, these things are essentially beautifully balanced in a timeless game of negotiation that is going on between the male and the female.
Fantastic. Well, this brings us to our first listener question. And the question has to do with the inhibitions of females when it comes to a potential casual mating strategy with men. The question centers around, does alcohol remove the inhibition from very attractive females? And I think what the listener is trying to ask is, not that does it remove inhibition from very attractive females, but does it remove inhibitions from all females so that males might be more likely to pursue a casual mating strategy and succeed in said attractive females?
Well, I believe so. This is it's not easy to get data on this, but a famous study was done by Jamie Pennebaker at SMU back in probably the 1970s, and that bore out this. He actually ran an experiment, which is very difficult to do, particularly when you're talking about getting people tipsy, but he managed to get it through an ethics committee and managed to pull this thing off, where both males and females became more attractive closer to closing time with alcohol. And so this is, yes, I think that's exactly what's going on, is that alcohol is a effectively acts as an anti-anxiety agent. It's been known for centuries as liquid courage. In other words, when you're normally supposed to have anxiety, if you pour alcohol on it, you will reduce that anxiety. It acts very, very similarly in the brain to a benzodiazepine like Xanax or Valium or any of these sorts of kind of drugs that knock out a bunch of your anxiety. And so alcohol will dull the anxiety down, and, of course, the female should be very anxious about giving up her eggs without any sign of commitment. And so the alcohol is going to be very helpful to the male casual mating strategy, which is precisely why, you know, these social processes involve bars. Exactly what this is about.
I remember somebody in a friends group at a party was asking, they were a little bit inebriated, and they told us in the group, they said, you know, they should have places in the bar where you can like go. So if you're looking for casual sex, you can just like skip all the different things and just like stand in that corner or sit on that bench. And that way anybody who's interested can come and sit next to you. And we were all joking with them. We said, there is a bench like that. It's at the front of the bar.
Yeah, actually, if you think about it, something that's very interesting in this whole thing, which is I don't think particularly mimicked in the animal kingdom. Perhaps it is. Well, it is to some degree, but and that is this. Well, there's nothing quite like humans in the animal kingdom in terms of how upset they are about being found unacceptable for mating. And so it's going to turn out that this is why, you know, these are charged situations emotionally. So in a bar, a man finds a female sexually appealing, wants to make his move, but he needs to be careful because he doesn't want to lose status in that situation and being seen as obviously making a play for a female and losing. And so that's touchy on his psychology. Females, are, on the other end of it, are maybe interested in a male from what it is that they look like and what they appear to be, and so they send positive signals, and they're drinking, and their inhibitions are dropping. But at the same time, once they start to talk to the male, they may not be very interested. And as a result, now they have to shut him down when they did encourage him. So these are... You know, these are pretty charged kind of situations, and they're interesting ones. But you're seeing some things that you're seeing some behavior that you wouldn't normally see in humans as a result of the alcohol being in the game, reducing the male's anxiety for making an ass out of himself or losing a flirtation in front of the village, and also watching the females getting more bold about signaling positive feedback to males because their anxiety about that whole process and where it could lead has been artificially reduced. So that's why it is. There's no accident why alcohol is smack dab in the middle of the casual mating dynamics in our culture.
And so the follow-up question from this listener is, are females capable of turning off their sexual inhibitions voluntarily? My guess is absolutely not.
No, of course not. No, the females are not at all capable of turning off their inhibitions voluntarily. They any more than a male can look at an 8 male can look at a 4 female and turn on his sexual excitation when he feels nothing. Okay, so these feelings are involuntary. Feelings are involuntary reactions to deep computations that the mind is performing. And if the cost-benefit analysis of the value proposition that's in front of you doesn't add up to what makes sense for you, given your personal knowledge of the adaptive landscape, and who it is that you are, and what you have to bring to the table, you can't do it. This is part and parcel of a much broader question, certainly about free will, which would be the biggest question on the table. But similar questions would be, can a person just decide to love somebody and just make a decision that they're going to be committed to them? No, you cannot. You cannot will your feelings in and out of existence. Your feelings are automated byproducts of very, very sophisticated cost-benefit equipment that runs in your head. And so you cannot do anything of the kind.
Yeah, I remember we were discussing a few shows back about the weight gain that females deal with in the 20, 30 years of their life, and how you mentioned that, can you imagine how much easier dating could be if men could turn off their circuits for detecting fertility and the S-curve detectors?
Sure. Of course. Yeah, that would be trivial. In other words, there's all kinds of women that you can look into their faces and you can see pretty, and you can know that you are in principle looking at an 8, but it looks like a 4, and that's because it's 70 pounds overweight. And so there's no possible way for the male mind to look past that, because that body shape looks like it's pregnant, and the essentially energy conservation mechanics inside of his brain say, forget it, not worth doing. And that's exactly what it feels like. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So all these emotions, positive, negative, everything, they work the same way.
Yeah, they all work the same way. They're all completely involuntary. You have no choice as to what you feel. I'm always amused and irritated when I hear psychologists say, well, if that's what you choose to believe, or you can choose to think this and you can choose to think that. Well, you can't choose anything of the kind. Your what you believe is true and what makes sense to you is not up to quote you. It's your brain is running deep automated algorithms that essentially make a decision as to what they think the truth is. And you don't have a choice about it. You have no more choice about that than, you know, it's an interesting thing as to what that would look like. Can you choose to believe anything, really? Can you choose to believe in Santa Claus? You know, how about Paul Bunyan? Okay, like, where does it end? How about Bigfoot? Okay, so how about the Loch Ness Monster? Like, at what point is it that you can choose to believe what? The answer is you cannot choose to believe anything. And and as a result, you can't choose to feel anything, because your feelings are ultimately based on what you believe to be the case. And these are very deep algorithms. You can't choose to believe a plain faced female that looks plain to you is beautiful. Can't do it. Okay, it can't be done. And it's quite distressing, and yet it is the case that a lot of this is quite objective. It's not totally objective, but it's quite objective. It means that in the game of man-woman relationships and in mating choice, there is the lion's share of the success that's involved here has to do with the genes that you were born with, and that's the way it is.
All right, so our next question actually has to do with potentially messing up these genes with medication. So
yes.
This is a question from one of our listeners, and it's a little bit long, so it just tells a nice little story about birth control. The question is, assume you have a female in her peak reproductive years, and she begins a sexual relationship with a male. Eventually, they start an exclusive, typical, modern-day dating relationship, and it lasts a period of time that extends well beyond the time it would ordinarily take a healthy, fertile female to get pregnant without birth control, say between 1 and 2 years, but not long enough to trigger the decline in sexual arousal that you typically see in long-term relationships lasting several years. However, throughout the relationship, the couple has taken precautions and has successfully used some form of birth control and avoided pregnancy. And also, let's assume that this is one of those magic 10% situations that you've referenced in past podcasts, where each person thinks they're getting a hell of a deal, and they're thrilled to be in the relationship. Do you think it's possible that in this situation, the female's Stone Age brain may cause the female to accelerate her loss of sexual attraction, desire, or interest for the male because, let's face it, she's been having sex with him for a long period of time, and he has, in fact, not yet impregnated her. The theory is that her Stone Age brain will attribute her lack of pregnancy to his infertility and signal to her that he is not, despite his superior physical attributes in her mind, a good mate choice due to a potential inherent defect affecting his fertility. Of course, logically, both
individuals... go ahead.
I would say the last sentence is, of course, logically, both individuals know the real reason she's not pregnant because they've been consciously and actively trying to prevent it.
Right. This is a great question. Very thoughtful, deep thinking. I first encountered this logic in a book called The Moral Animal, written by Robert Wright back in 1993. And outstanding work in evolutionary psychology, by the way, for anybody who's interested. He was speculating about this at that time, and I'm not aware of any data that backs this up. It wouldn't shock me if somebody found something like this. But I don't know. My guess is that the following is true. And this is going to be true for a number of things like this that could be related to this. So, for example, the use of birth control pills themselves will cause women to effectively feel pregnant. And as a result of that, they will have more conservative mating choices, et cetera. So there's a number of dynamics here. This is a very interesting speculation. Just to reiterate it for the listeners, the concept is if you're having sex with somebody for a year or two and there's no kid, is there a chip inside the female's head that says, whoa, nothing is happening here, and therefore there must be something wrong with this guy? That's the only reasonable guess from the standpoint of evolution, because if there's something wrong with you, there's no harm at all in trying it out another partner just to find out. And if it turns out you go 0 for 2, then you go 0 for 3 and see what happens. Try another one. But the correct inference from the standpoint of evolution would be to make is that this guy can't knock you up. And so does essentially having sex without issue winding up creating a distancing effect and the female wants to step around the male? I'm going to suspect that the following is true. I'm going to suspect that, and this is nothing other than my speculation, and there may be data, but I'm not aware of any, there may be a what we're going to call an effect size in this direction. So that wouldn't mean that you would find that it all would always happen. It would mean that if you looked at enough people and looked at enough population statistics on this particular issue, that you may very well find an effect where this tendency or this inference effectively gets occasionally activated. It might be in marginal situations where the female's not that hot on the male anyway. Et cetera. So that may be a tip her over the scales sort of an issue. I don't know, but it's a great question. It's actually a would be a fantastic doctoral dissertation if nobody's done it. So great question. And my answer is I suspect that there is something of that kind, but I suspect that the effect size is small. So I don't think it's a major influence in human behavior, but it very well might lead by, it very possibly could be a minor effect.
Yeah, and the next part of the question from this same exact listener is basically clarifying that the hormonal chemistry a woman has when she's pregnant causes her to prefer males displaying provider qualities and child-rearing qualities as opposed to simply superior genetic and reproductive qualities when she's trying to get pregnant. So you're saying this is actually true. This has been studied.
These are this is true at different points in the menstrual cycle. So when she's fertile, she's extremely preferential towards very sexy males, and when she's not fertile, she's very much prefers, guys that look like me. Okay, but sort of rounder, friendly, nice eyes. You know what I mean? They're pleasant characteristics that look like they're going to stick around, reliable, all this sort of thing. So
Long
this
walks
is,
on the beach.
like long walks on the beach and talking about all the things that I'm going to do for all that kind of stuff. So this is true, and so this is we can see how, for example, birth control could mix up a lot of mating dynamics potentially in people, and not that it would all be bad, but you could see situations where the following could be true, where a girl that's on birth control could meet a guy that she's not really that hot on, but he could be very hot on her because maybe she's trading down, and she's feeling conservative because she is essentially feeling that she's pregnant potentially. So she chooses a partner that is not very exciting but is reliable, that is into her. And meanwhile, if she ever gets off the birth control and they are thinking about having kids, it turns out that she's really not interested in him at all, and that she's very interested in other people. That you could see how that picture could be put together and probably has been lived by some people. I expect that female mating decisions in general are more of a hybrid of, in other words, the average female is trying to split the difference between two strategies. She's trying to find somebody who's kind of exciting but kind of dependable, and as a result, that she's probably playing both strategies all the time, and just may lean into a more conservative strategy, a relatively more conservative strategy when she's using birth control. So I don't expect that these are essentially either-or strategies. I think that these strategies are actually being played on a continuum.
And of course, if you add that to a very low conscientious female, she'll get the one where she'll get the provider and then cheat on him with the what's his name? With Jimmy,
Of course.
the 10, and then
Absolutely.
now Horace gets to pay for the kid.
Of course. That's right. So
But that's very
she'd have
rare, I'm
a
assuming.
bumper sticker. Don't be Horace. She'd have a bumper sticker. Don't be.
Yeah, on that same topic of I guess essentially screwing with the genes is a few years ago I read a Evolutionary Psychology the journal one of the articles that they published was about couples splitting up because they postulated that it was because of the perfumes that they both wore, the perfumes and colognes that masked the normal smell of the, I guess, the pheromones kind of thing, you know, like Love Potion number 9 type of thing, where they can smell each other's DNA signature, and with the perfumes and colognes on, it messed the whole thing up. It muddied the waters.
That's actually possible, and I think that's very interesting. I think some of the most interesting stuff that I've seen is that some of the scents that are now available actually definitely increase female libido with their partners, and I think that's fascinating that that's true. And they've actually got experimental evidence of this, and so anybody that's interested may want to look up the journals and look for that study and find it. I read it in the last year, and because my life is so boring, I didn't bother to follow it up. Well, there you go. But in principle, I should know what those scents are.
I know your tricks. You're just not sharing them, which I don't blame you at all.
That's giving me a lot of credit, Nate. Very well done.
All right. So our next question. This has to do, I'm assuming, again, with the casual mating strategy. This is about soft and hard value in the dating marketplace. So this listener says, from listening to your show, I recently became aware of soft versus hard market value. A male who might have been, say, unpopular in high school and was very, very thin and just, you know, had a pimply face and everything like that may have had a hard value of, say, a 5, but as they got older, as they grew into themselves, they got a good job, etc., they may have been able to expand it to a soft 7. But deep inside, he may still have a psychology of a 5. Mm-hmm. So when Dr. Lyle said about losing fall status, it strongly reminded me about fitness testing that women might subject men to. And by fitness test, this listener is referring to the little questions, the I think you call them cross-examinations, when they are trying to figure out what the actual genetic value of a male is. And if you can pass them, the fitness test, by joking or humor, or you just don't let it affect you, you don't get too irritated by it. This listener is assuming that if you can pass them, then the female is the status is preserved. Otherwise, your real status takes a hit, and you know you don't get the chance. So the question for Dr. Lyle is: can you comment on this type of fitness testing that females do, and is there a way to pass them without loss or anything negative?
Well, this is very interesting. It's sort of an interesting question, and there's a lot of there's a lot of supposition that's sitting under questions like this. First of all, let's look at what a date is. So, what a date is if it's a blind date, nobody knows if anybody qualifies. Okay, so you're walking in there, and there's no telling whether you qualify physically or not. If the female does not qualify physically, this thing is done. Okay, it's over. The male is just going to be polite or impolite, and he's out of there. The female may not qualify physically for pair bond strategy, at which point she may qualify for casual mating strategy, and then we've got, you know, this sort of mess on our hands where the male is just trying to figure out how little he can maneuver, how little action he has to do, and how little resources he has to pony up before he could get to the casual mating strategy, and he's running cost-benefit analysis about just how fancy that is.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.